This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the Cold War ended, America had to rethink its defense and military priorities. My guest Michael Clare says we may be heading in the wrong direction. We're designing a military that is geared to fight another Gulf War, another war with a so-called rogue state. But Clare says we're not preparing for the other more common peril that faces us, the global chaos caused by ethnic wars, religious conflicts, and nationalist struggles. In other words, he says, while we prepare to fight another war with a rogue state like Iraq, we have no strategy for dealing with Bosnia, Rwanda, or Haiti. Clare is a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. He's the author of the new book, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, America's Search for a New Foreign Policy. The book critiques the wisdom of building our defense strategy around the rogue state.
The rogue state is a manufactured concept. It describes a group of rising third world powers that are considered hostile by U.S. leaders, countries like Libya and Iran and Iraq and North Korea that have a history of hostility to the United States. Also, countries that are pursuing weapons of mass destruction, chemical or nuclear weapons, in violation of international norms. It's a combination of hostility and the pursuit of weapons of mass destruction that's been described by this term rogue states.
What do you think of this as being a manufactured threat? It seems like these states pose real threats.
They certainly do pose threats, but in the panoply of possible threats or of proliferators, they're not at the top of the list. Countries like India and Pakistan and Israel, Argentina and Brazil have moved much further in the proliferation direction than the countries that I've named that are really Johnny-come-latelys. So we do want to do everything we can to stop them in their tracks, and I think that's entirely possible. But the problem of proliferation really requires that we look at countries that have gone much further in this direction, like India and Pakistan, and find ways to persuade them to dismantle their very elaborate nuclear infrastructure.
You're actually very cynical about how the rogue state came to be such a centerpiece of our foreign policy.
I think that it's understandable that the Department of Defense, with the crisis they faced after the fall of the Berlin Wall of not having an identifiable enemy anymore, that they sought enemies around which to organize their thinking, their budget plans, their strategy plans. It's a very natural thing that they've done. And I understand how they came to this process of choosing these states as our next enemy. The problem to me is that this was never debated by the American people or Congress, and we've never had a chance to argue whether we want to build our defense policy about the prospects of endless wars with this group of third world countries.
Maybe you could describe for us how our defense policy is defined by the rogue states.
Under our current military policy, which is called the bottom-up review, this was done by Secretary of Defense Les Aspin in 1993 before he was replaced by the current Secretary of Defense. The bottom-up review says that the United States shall be prepared indefinitely into the future to fight two Desert Storm-like wars against Iraq-like emerging third world powers. It's called a two-war strategy or the two major regional conflict scenario. So we're going to have enough army divisions and aircraft carriers and tactical fighter planes to fight two desert storms simultaneously. And when you work out the math, that comes out to be a force only slightly smaller than the one that we devised for fighting the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War period.
So in your mind, is the rogue state scenario a rationale for keeping up defense forces?
In my view, it's a rationale for keeping up certain kinds of defense forces, forces which are intended to fight large, modern militaries equipped with modern weapons. In other words, countries that look like the former Warsaw Pact. And certainly North Korea fits that to some degree. The question is, are those the kinds of threats that our military is going to face? As I've suggested, that's among the least likely scenarios we're going to face is two desert storms simultaneously. We're much more likely to see a rash of Rwanda's, Haiti's, Bosnia's occurring simultaneously. And I think for that, we need a very different kind of force.
Well, I want to get to that idea in a second, but it does seem like there are enough third world countries with dictators who are either mentally unstable or utterly unpredictable, who, even though it's not in their national interest to do so, would challenge the United States, like Saddam Hussein.
Well, Saddam Hussein, at the time that he started the invasion of Kuwait, had a number of very peculiar circumstances that I don't think are repeatable. First of all, he had a million-man army with the best weaponry that a third-world leader has ever accumulated, and there's nobody else like that now. He was also under the impression that he had a friend in the White House, George Bush, who practically up to the last minute before the invasion of Kuwait was reassuring Saddam Hussein of America's friendship. And I think that Hussein didn't appreciate how things had changed in Washington and how his behavior would prompt a very strong reaction. Had he known that, I don't think he would have gone ahead. But he acted under a very cold calculation that told him he had a good chance of success.
Think of how close we came to fighting with North Korea.
Yes, I'm very worried about it. And there's a case where I think the leadership on both sides, in the North and the South, understands that a war between the two would be an absolute catastrophe no matter who won. There's likely to be a million dead people, including many American soldiers, and terrible destruction on both sides. And I think there is an understanding there that war should be avoided at all costs. And yet we did see a period last spring about this time when the U.S. and North Korea were moving in the direction of war. And I think it's only when Jimmy Carter went to North Korea and talked with North Korean leaders that they were able to turn that momentum around.
But doesn't that make you think that maybe we are pretty close to fighting with rogue states?
I do worry very much that this kind of demonology of calling these states rogues and seeing them as implacable foes will create a self-fulfilling prophecy in which we'll jump into a war with them that might otherwise have been avoided. I do worry about that.
Well, how does calling a state like North Korea or Iraq a rogue state lead to the possibility of a self-fulfilling prophecy of war?
Well, first of all, our military is training all of the time to go to war with these countries. These are the designated enemies. And so when an incident occurs, like these two American citizens who have been captured by the Iraqis and sentenced to jail, or the Iranians setting up bases in the Persian Gulf, our tendency is to view this as a very serious crisis and to think about military options. If we were dealing with an ally, a country that or a country we felt friendly about, we would be sending ambassadors over, perhaps, having high-level meetings, but not threatening military action, which is the case with the rogues.
But what would you call Iraq under Saddam Hussein or North Korea as it defies all kind of international nuclear standards? What would you call them other than rogue states?
I would call them rising third world powers, like others that we have very friendly relations with, like India and Israel and Argentina and Brazil, that engaged in even more egregious violations of non-proliferation agreements.
Well, what's the logical next step after that, that we should be treating North Korea like Israel or Israel like North Korea?
Well, I think that nuclear nonproliferation has to be enforced equally and unilaterally to all countries. Otherwise, it's going to give the impression that it's okay for some countries to pursue nuclear weapons and not others. And I don't think that's the message we want to communicate. I think the message we want to communicate is that no country should be pursuing nuclear or chemical weapons and will face sanctions if they do.
Michael Clare is my guest. He's a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and author of the new book, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, America's Search for a New Foreign Policy. You are arguing that we should be gearing our defense policy toward dealing with what has happened, for instance, in Bosnia and Somalia and Haiti, regional conflicts, ethnic conflicts, and instead we're gearing our foreign policy around rogue states like North Korea and Iraq. What's the difference between how we would equip our military to deal with the regional conflicts that you think we should be worrying about and the rogue state scenario that is more central to our current defense policy?
The current policy, the bottom-up review, which assumes we're going to be fighting an infinite series of desert storm-like operations, calls for a very high-tech, capital-intensive, heavy-unit kind of army. Lots of tanks, lots of supersonic jet planes with advanced munitions, big ships, aircraft carriers. When we're looking at ethnic and sectarian conflicts and peacekeeping and humanitarian rescue, you want light forces, lightly equipped forces that could be moved quickly to different parts of the world, operate in an austere landscape where there are very few facilities, but bring in what's needed in the way of medical care and communications, and that's able to get in and out very rapidly and doesn't have a lot of heavy equipment.
Do you think we basically need two different sets of forces, one to fight and one as peacekeepers, each to be trained completely differently?
Well, what I think we need for a national security posture is an ability to do many different things. It is possible that we'll have to fight again on a large scale as in Desert Storm. I'm not ruling that out, and we need some capacity to be able to do that. What I'm arguing about now is we've put all our eggs in this one basket of major regional conflicts and not left any capability or resources for all the other imaginable problems that we're going to have. So what we need is a lot of flexibility and an ability to do different sorts of things as needed, as the world situation demands.
I know you admire Jimmy Carter's efforts to mediate international disputes. What's he doing right?
What Jimmy is doing right, and it sometimes rankles us too, I might say, is saying at the beginning that all sides have a legitimate point of view in this and that we have to hear all sides, that there isn't a good guys and a bad guys, or one side is beyond the pale, beyond talking to. And I think when he went to talk with the Bosnian Serbs, I felt very uncomfortable, and many people do, that these people have done terrible things. And yet, if you're going to resolve conflict without violence, you have to go to the other side. You have to hear their point of view. You have to hear their grievances and resentments, as well as the side you might feel more comfortable with. And that's what he's doing right.
Michael Clare, the first time you joined us on Fresh Air several years ago, I think the subject was low-intensity conflict, acronym being LIC, L-I-C. And this is a subject you'd been writing about for years, how small, regional, low-intensity conflicts were becoming the most common wars and how these were going to be the wars of the future as well. I don't hear that expression very much anymore, although it still seems we're very concerned with outbreaks of small conflicts around the world. So where are we now in terms of what had been called low-intensity conflict? And how does your point of view now compare to the point of view you had a few years ago when you were writing about low-intensity conflict?
Well, I think the big difference, Terry, is when the term was developed in the 1980s, LIC, low-intensity conflict, the assumption was that this was a manifestation of the Cold War, that either we were supporting a group that was fighting the Soviet Union and its allies, like we were supporting the Contras, or we were supporting a government against a communist-supported insurgency. So that in each case, there were good guys and bad guys, and we were going to be on the side that we thought of as the good guys. So we were either aiding insurgency, pro-insurgency, the Reagan Doctrine, or we were in counterinsurgency, fighting against an insurgency. we still see many ethnic and sectarian conflicts, but now we don't see them as manifestations of the Cold War, where there are good guys and bad guys. More often than not, we don't take sides, and we shouldn't take sides in these conflicts. Our interests are in peace and in reconciliation of the parties. And I think that's a very different sort of environment and a very different sort of challenge. We're not going in to win a conflict. We're going in to prevent it or resolve it or ameliorate the killing. It's a different sort of responsibility.
Michael Clare, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry.
Michael Clare is the author of the book Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws. He's defense correspondent for The Nation and a professor at Hampshire College. This is Fresh Air.